Good afternoon and welcome to Outlook Live. I'm Jean Rourke with the Center for Learning Innovation at the St. Louis Fed, and I'll be your moderator. Today's topic is 2018 Interagency Fair Lending Hot Topics. Shortly, I'll turn our call over to Virtha Hassan at the Federal Reserve Board, but first, I'll run through our call logistics on slide 2. And if you haven't done so yet, click on the webinar link you received after registering. Or you can head over to our website at www.consumercomplianceoutlook.org. There, you can find the session materials and eventually the archive of the call. Just a quick note about the webinar. We encourage you to listen to the audio through your PC, but if you need a phone option, we have a limited number of phone lines available. If you choose to listen to the audio through your phone, I've added a few notes to the webinar player page, and you could review the webinar FAQ, which can be found in the materials section, if you'd like additional guidance for using the phone. As for questions, please submit them by clicking the Ask Question button in the webinar. And I just want to remind you that we are offering continuing professional education credits for attending this session. If you're interested in that, you must do two things. First, you must be registered for today's session, and the second, you must request it by completing the post-session survey. All right, let me cover the legal language before turning our call over to Virtha. The opinions expressed in this presentation are intended for informational purposes and are not formal opinions of nor binding on the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System. All right, with all of that out of the way, I will turn the call over to Virtha Hassan.
My name is Virtha Hussain. I'm the Managing Counsel for Fair Lending Enforcement at the Federal Reserve's Division of Consumer and Community Affairs. I'll be your facilitator today for the 2018 Interagency Fair Lending Hot Topics webinar. This call is scheduled for 90 minutes. I'd like to start the call by thanking all of our agency presenters. We will take questions at the end, but I think we're ready to kick off with the presentations. Leading us off is Lucy Carlson from the Department of Justice. So Lucy, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Virtha. So we're on the slide that says U.S. Department of Justice on the front. My name is Lucy Carlson, and I'm a deputy for Fair Lending Matters in the Civil Rights Division at the Department of Justice. I'm going to talk this afternoon about our recent redlining case, United States v. Klein Bank, that settled this year. Next slide. We got some advanced questions about Klein Bank and about redlining, and I just want to apologize in advance for not responding to all of them because I've been allotted 10 minutes, and there is no way that we can cover everything about this case in 10 minutes because, you know, there are some complicated issues. The Department of Justice has filed a number of redlining cases in the past, but Klein Bank is the first redlining case that was litigated by the Department of Justice. And that just means that it's the first case that did not settle at the time it was filed, and we went forward in the litigation process. I think it's important to talk about this case because the court orders are significant, in part because there are few court cases related to redlining. So first, I'm going to talk a little bit about the investigation. We opened this investigation in May of 2015. And conducted a thorough investigation using information that we obtained from Klein Bank, and we also reviewed publicly available information. The FDIC is Klein Bank's prudential regulator, and we coordinated with the FDIC throughout this matter. When we began this investigation, it was not based on a referral from a regulator. It was based on the Attorney General's independent enforcement authority under the statute. Next slide, please. I'm going to talk a little bit about what was in our complaint, and you can find the complaint on the DOJ website if you're interested in looking at it in detail. We filed the complaint in January 2017, and it alleges violations under the Fair Housing Act and the Equal Credit Opportunity Act. The allegations in this complaint are consistent with redlining cases that we've brought in the past. The complaint essentially alleged that Klein Bank treated white neighborhoods differently the neighborhoods where the residents were mostly minority race or national origin groups, and that because of the race of the residents of the neighborhood, the bank avoided providing services there. The allegations in the Klein Bank complaint are under a disparate treatment theory, And that means that we allege that the bank treated potential borrowers differently based on the racial makeup of their neighborhood. The complaint alleged essentially four categories, types of evidence, and that's here on the slide. These are probably familiar to anyone who has looked at redlining because these are the types of evidence that examiners look at, the types of evidence the department looks at in its investigations, and this is the type of evidence that is in all of our previous redlining complaints. Next slide. So the next slide, and I understand that there's a little bit of a lag between the time I say next slide and the time you see the next slide, but when you see it, you'll see that this is a map that was an exhibit to the Klein Bank complaint, and it gives a visual representation of the CRA assessment area and shows the locations of the branches. So Klein Bank is located in Minneapolis, and this is a map of Minneapolis and the surrounding areas. The counties are outlined and labeled, and the assessment area is shaded in sort of a purplish hatch marks. The census tracts are shaded to show the population, the race and national origin of the population, showing red if it's a majority-minority tract, white if it's a majority-white tract, and sort of a range in between that. And it shows the Klein Bank branch locations that are indicated by a dot surrounded by blue shading. This map is based on 2010 census data, and this is the map that we included as part of our complaint. So I want to point out, as you look at the map, the allegation of the complaint was that this assessment area was a horseshoe-shaped assessment area, and it's sort of a horseshoe on its side. And the two counties that are inside the horseshoe, to the west, that's Minneapolis, which is in Hennepin County, and part of Hennepin County was included in the assessment area, and part was not included in the bank's assessment area. The county in the horseshoe that's a little bit further to the west is Ramsey County, and that's the county where St. Paul is located. So you can see here, you know, what the assessment area looked like, and you can also see that all of the branches were located in majority white areas. Next slide, please. In addition to the allegations of the complaint, I want to talk for a few minutes about the bank's motion to dismiss. A motion to dismiss is basically an argument that the allegations of the complaint don't add up to a violation of the law. Klein Bank filed a motion to dismiss, and there was also a group of bankers' associations that filed a brief supporting motion to dismiss. There were a number of arguments in the motion to dismiss, and I don't have time to discuss them all today, but I have a couple that I want to highlight. So the first is that Klein Bank argued that because the complaint did not allege direct evidence of discrimination, it didn't sufficiently plead discriminatory intent. I just want to unpack that a little bit. Direct evidence is evidence that, in another context, we sometimes think of as smoke and gun evidence. And so, you know, hypothetical direct evidence for a redlining case might be a memo in which the bank says it doesn't want to lend in certain neighborhoods because of the race of the people in that neighborhood. So I assume that most of you work for banks, and right now you're shaking your heads going, there is no way anyone would write a memo like that. And I agree. Direct evidence like that is very rare, and courts in past cases have noted that it's rare. And there are quite a few court cases that make it clear that when you're trying to show intent of discriminatory intent, that it needs to be shown through circumstantial evidence, usually. And so the United States' response to this argument in the motion to dismiss was that if you take the allegations together, the categories that are listed here on the slide, if proven, they'll establish circumstantial evidence of discriminatory intent. And those four categories, the discriminatory CRA assessment area, the bank's marketing strategy of marketing to white neighborhoods and not marketing to majority and minority neighborhoods, the bank's branching strategy, where it chose to locate its branches, and also allegations related to our statistical analysis. So, you know, we believe that those are enough together to show evidence of the bank's intent to discriminate. Next slide, please. So we're at the slide that says Magistrate Judge's Report and Recommendation. This case had two judges. It was reviewed by a magistrate judge and also by a United States district judge in federal court. And so this slide is what the magistrate had to say about the sufficiency of the evidence in response to the argument that I just talked about on the previous slide. The court looked at the types of evidence alleged in the complaint, the branching, the assessment area, the marketing, the statistical evidence, and said that these types of facts are enough to support a claim of redlining. Essentially, the court looked at the types of evidence that both DOJ and prudential regulators look at when they're conducting a redlining investigation or a redlining focal point in an exam, and the judge said that this information can support a claim of discrimination. The magistrate judge took particular note of branching and marketing and said that Klein Bank's decision to put branches in loan officers and to market in white areas that are densely populated but avoided minority areas in Minneapolis and St. Paul that were similarly densely populated seemed to indicate a business philosophy of avoiding minority borrowers. Next slide. The other argument that I want to talk about quickly is Klein Bank's argument that the Department of Justice should not be allowed to file a lawsuit because Klein Bank claims that the FDIC had examined it for redlining and not found redlining. So the complaint included a specific allegation that the FDIC did not conduct a redlining investigation of Klein Bank during the relevant time period. Klein Bank argued that regulators always do a redlining exam when conducting a CRA exam, and that the interagency exam procedures require a redlining exam with the CRA exam. And I think sort of the essential argument was that because Klein Bank got satisfactory CRA ratings, it couldn't be accused of redlining. And in response to that argument, the United States said that first, there was no redlining exam, but that even if there were a redlining exam, the Equal Credit Opportunity Act gives the Attorney General independent authority to bring fair lending lawsuits. So the Department of Justice can bring a suit without a referral from a regulator and regardless of that CRA rating. Next slide, please. The magistrate judge rejected the bank's argument on this and said essentially that a satisfactory CRA rating doesn't affect the department's ability to file a lawsuit, that the Attorney General can file a suit even if the bank has a satisfactory CRA assessment rating. Next slide. So after the magistrate judge reviewed this motion, the district judge also reviewed this motion and adopted the report and recommendation that the magistrate had written. But the judge also wrote his own order, and he noted particularly that some of the allegations in the complaint would require intent. And so those are listed here on the slide, that if these were proven, there would have to be some intent if these things were true. And so at the time of the motion to dismiss, the parties had already been talking about settlement. And so we continued to talk about settlement, and the next couple of slides, next slide please, discuss the settlement. And since I'm getting very short on time, I'm not going to talk too much about the settlement, but I do want to say that we view this as a very favorable settlement. The Department of Justice tries to make the settlement a win for both sides. We're making credit available in minority neighborhoods, but we also want to help the bank grow its business. In some of our past settlements, lenders have acknowledged that their actions taken under the settlement ended up being good for business. Although this settlement is similar to past redlining settlements, we tailor the remedies to fit the facts of the case, including the lender's business model and the markets where the lender does business. Next slide. So this last slide talks about the essential elements of the settlement, but I think that the main takeaway from the case, just sort of my wrap-up here, is that the magistrate judge and the district court looked at the kind of evidence that the Department of Justice looks at in its redlining investigation, which is the same types of evidence that regulators look at in redlining focal points, and said that this type of evidence can show the intent of a bank to redline. The order is very favorable to our redlining enforcement work, and we will be citing it in the future. So with that, I'm going to pass this off to Tara Oxley from the FDIC.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Today I'm going to discuss how the FDIC conducts its fair lending reviews and specifically assesses fair lending risk as an institution. Although the majority of our institutions sufficiently identify and mitigate their fair lending risk, we find that when issues do arise, they are typically due to an institution not having an appropriate framework for assessing risk. Thus, that's what I'm going to discuss here today. Next slide, please. As explained in our FDIC compliance examination manual, the FDIC's examinations are risk-focused. This means that the FDIC directs its resources to those areas where there is the greatest risk of consumer harm. Thus, examiners do not transaction test for specific violations. Rather, they evaluate a bank's compliance management system, or CMS, and identify areas of risk. Because of this, not all examinations will be the same, and you should not assume what occurred at one examination or at one institution will occur this time around. The same approach is used for fair lending. As such, the FDIC does not have particular areas of focus for our fair lending reviews. Rather, the area of focus will be dependent on the examiner's identification of areas wherein there is fair lending risk. And today, I'll explain exactly what this looks like. Next slide, please. The FDIC's fair lending reviews are conducted in accordance with the Interagency Fair Lending Examination Procedures, which I will refer to today as the Interagency Procedures. Consistent with the interagency procedures, FDIC examiners scope for fair lending risk by completing three general steps. First, examiners develop an institutional overview to assess an institution's inherent fair lending risk. This requires examiners to fully understand a financial institution's lending operations so they can identify the level of inherent risk and decide whether more review is needed. Second, if more than minimal inherent risk exists, examiners will review the discrimination risk factors and assess an institution's CMS for fair lending. Understanding the strength of an institution's CMS is necessary to properly assess whether an institution has sufficiently mitigated applicable discrimination risk factors. Third, for those discrimination risk factors that have not been fully mitigated, examiners compile a list of potential focal points and identify which, if any, should be pursued as a focal point. Examiners use a document called the Fair Lending Scope and Conclusions Memo to document their review. Included at the end of my presentation is a link to this document, so I encourage you to use a document like this as we go through the scoping process. Now I'm going to discuss each step a bit more. Next slide, please. As I just mentioned, examiners first develop an institutional overview to understand where there is inherent fair lending risk. To do this, examiners review a variety of documents, including loan policies and procedures, board, loan, and committee minutes, monitoring and/or audit reports, and exception tracking reports, just to name a few. Examiners will not only look at the institution's operations, but also whether any third parties have a role in the lending process. Where third parties are involved, examiners will seek to understand the role of the third party and identify areas of risk. Examiners may also need to conduct interviews to obtain information or clarifications throughout this process. Additionally, examiners will need to understand the bank's assessment area and market area. As such, there may be questions or inquiries related to this as well. Once examiners have gathered this information, they will identify the level of inherent risk that exists in the institution. If there is minimal inherent risk, no further analysis is necessary. This typically occurs where the institution has a strong fair lending compliance record, management remains unchanged and was previously deemed effective, the market area consists of a homogeneous population, and there's no discretion in the lending process. However, in the majority of instances, examiners will move forward with their fair lending reviews to the second step. Next slide, please. Where there is more than minimal inherent risk, examiners will next identify a product or product groups to review. For each product selected, examiners will review the applicable discrimination risk factors and consider whether the institution has mitigated the identified risk. Here again, I encourage you to refer to the interagency procedures. They spell out the discrimination risk factors for each type of discrimination. As for mitigating factors typically result from the strength of an institution's CMS. Understanding an institution's CMS allows examiners to evaluate the institution's capacity to prevent or to identify and self-correct fair lending violations in connection with the products selected for analysis. The interagency procedures provide a compliance management analysis checklist that can assist examiners in evaluating an institution's fair lending CMS. There's a link to this document in the last page of my presentation. With respect to evaluating a CMS, I wanted to note a few things. As for board and management oversight, it's important to note that oversight could be strong in one area of the institution's lending, but fail to mitigate the discrimination risk in another area. Thus, you should look at the board and management's oversight as it relates to each product. As for policies and procedures, they should sufficiently address the product and risks under review and be fully implemented by the institution's lending staff. Policies and procedures can only mitigate risk if they are actually implemented. With respect to training, examiners will not only determine if training has occurred, but also who received the training, how often such training occurs, the substance of the training, and whether it covers the specific discrimination risk identified. Thus, you should consider these factors too. For monitoring and or audit, examiners will determine if the monitoring or audit function is appropriate for the size, complexity, and risk profile of the institution. Also, if such monitoring or audit identifies an issue, examiners will seek to understand what the institution did with such information and whether it sufficiently mitigated any risks identified. Finally, with respect to consumer complaints, an institution should have procedures for handling complaints and ensure issues are promptly analyzed, thoroughly reviewed, and appropriate corrective action is taken. The majority of our fair lending reviews conclude here. That is, examiners find that banks are sufficiently mitigating their risk. However, in those situations where such risk is not mitigated and there is a risk of consumer harm, examiners move forward with a possible focal point. Next slide, please. As set forth in the interagency procedures, the last step in the scoping process is for examiners to select those focal points that warrant examination based on the relative risk levels identified throughout the scoping process. Where multiple potential focal points exist, examiners will pick those that have the highest risk of consumer harm. As stated in the interagency procedures, examiners will prioritize several factors when selecting focal points. These are listed on the slide here. Next slide, please. As I previously mentioned, this slide lists some helpful resources you can refer to that will help you understand this risk-focused review process. Because I already discussed the items in the first two bullet points, I won't discuss them further here. However, I do want to note that in the third bullet point, I referenced the technical assistance video on managing fair lending risk. I encourage you to review that video as it's a great resource and goes into greater depth on several fair lending risk issues. And with that, I'll conclude my presentation and turn it over to Catherine Ray from the OCC.
Thank you, Tara, and good afternoon to everyone on the line. We should be on slide 24 now, the slide that says overview. My topic today is mortgage pricing risks. I'll be focusing on two areas of continuing risk, relationships with brokers and other third parties, and discount pricing or exception programs. I'll discuss the fair lending risks of these relationships and programs, warning signs that may indicate potential fair lending issues, and approaches to address these risks. Next slide, please. Let's start with third-party originators. A number of institutions use brokers to source mortgages or to grow their mortgage business into new geographic or product areas. We have observed that the fair lending risk associated with these relationships increases if policies allow for broad pricing discretion. Now, this can be true even if there are caps on broker compensation. For example, setting caps at a high level or permitting brokers to vary compensation methods can result in variations in pricing, even where borrowers are similarly situated. And in turn, these variations in pricing can contribute to fair lending risk. Lack of clear guidelines and documentation requirements for brokers is another risk area. A lack of objective criteria for mortgage brokers to follow when assessing fees increases fair lending risks. But even if a bank has clear policies and procedures governing its third-party relationships, if it fails to monitor for compliance with those policies, there can still be risk. For instance, if brokers who are exceeding pricing caps go undetected, the bank can still face heightened risk. If a bank discovers that its brokers are not following bank policies and procedures, it should have a plan in place to take appropriate action. As with all other channels, banks should also be conducting monitoring commensurate with the size, risk, and complexity of their third-party portfolios. Banks should monitor and understand whether pricing outcomes vary on a prohibited basis and follow up as appropriate. Depending on the size and scope of the bank's operations, this could entail monitoring on a portfolio level as well as on an individual broker level. Taking follow-up action as warranted if problems are discovered is also an important component of a risk management program. Next slide, please. Now let's turn to pricing exceptions and discount programs. These programs can, of course, be beneficial to consumers and help a bank increase its lending, expand existing customer relationships, and better serve all customers. However, these programs can pose additional fair lending risk if not carefully designed, implemented, and monitored. Next slide, please. Fair lending risk associated with discount or exception pricing programs is increased if the policy does not clearly define the criteria for receiving a discount or if loan officers are not adequately informed or trained. Programs with lower fair lending risk have the following features. The criteria for offering a discount is clear, and the amount of the discount is well defined, both in policies and procedures and in training materials. Implementation is very important, and a proper rollout with adequate training, guidance, and appropriate oversight can help in managing fair lending risk. Risk can also be managed by tracking and monitoring exceptions and discounts to determine whether outcomes are linked to prohibited basis characteristics and by taking a corrective action as appropriate. A high volume of discretionary pricing exceptions is suggestive of increased fair lending risk, particularly if outcomes are correlated with prohibited basis characteristics. Policies and procedures that require documentation of eligibility for the exception or discount can help to manage fair lending risk. Effective monitoring of exceptions should also include monitoring of the bank's overall mortgage data. Next slide, please. I'll just take a few minutes to reinforce some of the compliance management concepts I've already touched on. A bank's compliance management system can help manage fair lending risk associated with brokers and discount programs if it is appropriate for the size, risk, and complexity of the bank's operations. In particular, effective fair lending risk management elements include adequate policies and procedures, training materials and guidance to help loan officers or others avoid fair lending risk, robust exception monitoring and oversight, fair lending self-evaluations that are commensurate with the size, risk, and complexity of a bank's lending activities, and appropriate and timely corrective action if fair lending issues are identified. The OCC will review elements of a bank's compliance management systems during the OCC's Fair Lending Risk Assessment, which is conducted during every supervisory cycle and informs our supervisory strategy for a given bank. During a risk assessment, examiners review a bank's fair lending risk by looking at features of specific products, delivery channels, underwriting, pricing, marketing, originator compensation, reputation risk, including, importantly, complaints, and other previously identified supervisory concerns. Complaints, for example, can be a potential indicator of risk management weaknesses. Examiners assess the volume, themes, and trends of complaints to determine if there are indications of concerns that would warrant further attention. And examiners will also review the bank's complaint process to see if the bank is tracking and addressing complaints. The OCC also evaluates the quality of a bank's risk management and controls. The OCC reviews the bank's policies and procedures, training, audit and compliance testing, and self-evaluation process. And we use this information to gain a bigger picture understanding of the bank's fair lending risk. By implementing an internal fair lending risk assessment process, a bank can also gain a more complete picture of its fair lending risk across its portfolio. Next slide, please. Finally, I'll wrap up with a few OCC resources that may be helpful in thinking through how to address fair lending risks presented by the issues that I discussed today. Bulletin 2013-29, Third-Party Relationships, and the Supplemental Frequently Asked Questions provide high-level principles-based guidance to national banks and federal savings associations. The OCC's Fair Lending Handbook, based on the interagency procedures, contains guidance for examiners when evaluating both third-party relationships and loan pricing. And with that, I'll turn things over to Matt Nixon from NCUA.
Thanks, Catherine. Good afternoon. I'm Matt Nixon, and I work in NCUA's Office of Consumer Financial Protection. In 2017 and 2018, NCUA examiners identified patterns or practices of discrimination based on borrowers' marital status in more than one credit union. The discrimination cases were similar, suggesting that some credit unions may be unaware of anti-discrimination requirements as they pertain to marital status. The topic of my presentation today is marital status discrimination. Slide 31, please. Today, I'll briefly discuss ECOA's prohibited bases. I'll provide information on marital status considerations addressed in Regulation B, and I'll discuss NCUA's recent marital status discrimination cases. Slide 32, please. The Equal Credit Opportunity Act prohibits discrimination in any aspect of a credit transaction on the basis of race or color, religion, national origin, sex, marital status, age, the applicant's receipt of income derived from any public assistance program, and the applicant's exercise in good faith of any right under the Consumer Credit Protection Act. The general rule covers all dealings without exception between an applicant and a creditor, whether or not addressed by other provisions of the regulation. The general rule covers, for example, application procedures, criteria used to evaluate creditworthiness, administration of accounts, and treatment of delinquent or slow accounts. Whether or not specifically prohibited elsewhere in Regulation B, a credit practice that treats applicants differently on a prohibited basis violates the law because it violates the general rule. Disparate treatment on a prohibited basis is illegal whether or not it results from a conscious intent to discriminate. Regulation B specifically addresses marital status and spousal relationships in a number of sections. I will discuss some of those sections in the next series of slides. Slide 33, please. Regulation B's signature rules ensure that qualified applicants are able to obtain credit in their own names. A creditor generally shall not require the signature of an applicant's spouse or other person other than a joint applicant on any credit instrument if the applicant qualifies under the creditor's standards of creditworthiness for the amount and terms of the credit requested. Stated differently, it is impermissible for a creditor to require an applicant who is individually creditworthy to provide a cosigner, even if the creditor applies the requirement without regard to sex, marital status, or any other prohibited basis. Slide 34, please. When an applicant requests individual credit but does not meet a creditor's standards, the creditor may require a cosigner, guarantor, endorser, or similar party, but cannot require that it be the spouse. Slide 35, please. Regulation B provides some exceptions to its signature rules. A creditor may require the signature of the applicant's spouse or other person on any instrument necessary or reasonably believed by the creditor to be necessary under applicable state law to make the property being offered as security available to satisfy the debt in the event of default. If a married applicant requests unsecured credit and resides in a community property state, or if the applicant is relying on property located in such a state, a creditor may require the signature of the spouse on any instrument necessary or reasonably believed by the creditor to be necessary under applicable state law to make the community property available to satisfy the debt in the event of default if, one, applicable state law denies the applicant power to manage or control sufficient community property to qualify for the credit requested under the creditor's standards of creditworthiness, and two, the applicant does not have sufficient separate property to qualify for the credit requested without regard to community property. Also, a creditor may require the personal guarantee of the partners, directors, or officers of a business and the shareholders of a closely held corporation, even if the business or corporation is creditworthy. The rules, however, prohibit a creditor from requiring the signature of a guarantor's spouse, just as they prohibit the creditor from requiring the signature of an applicant's spouse. For example, although a creditor may require all officers of a closely held corporation to personally guarantee a corporate loan, the creditor may not automatically require that spouses of married officers also sign the guarantee. Slide 36, please. Generally, a creditor may not request any information concerning the spouse or former spouse of an applicant. However, a creditor may request any information concerning an applicant's spouse that may be requested about the applicant if the spouse will be permitted to use the account, the spouse will be contractually liable on the account, the applicant is relying on the spouse's income as a basis for repayment of the credit requested, the applicant resides in a community property state, or is relying on property located in such a state as a basis for repayment of the credit requested, or the applicant is relying on alimony, child support, or separate maintenance payments from a spouse or former spouse as a basis for repayment of the credit requested. Slide 37, please. If an applicant applies for individual unsecured credit, a creditor shall not inquire about the applicant's marital status unless the applicant resides in a community property state or is relying on property located in such a state as a basis for repayment of the credit requested. If an application is for other than individual unsecured credit, a creditor may inquire about the applicant's marital status, but shall use only the terms married, unmarried, and separated. A creditor may explain that the category unmarried includes single, divorced, and widowed persons. Slide 38, please. The fact that certain credit-related information may indirectly disclose marital status does not bar a creditor from seeking such information. For example, the creditor may ask about the applicant's obligation to pay alimony, child support, or separate maintenance income, the source of income to be used as the basis for repaying the credit requested, which could disclose that it is the income of a spouse, whether any obligation disclosed by the applicant has a co-obligor, which could disclose that the co-obligor is a spouse or former spouse, and the ownership of assets, which could disclose the interest of a spouse. Slide 39, please. As mentioned at the beginning of my presentation, in 2017 and 2018, NCUA examiners identified patterns or practices of discrimination based on borrowers' marital status in more than one credit union, and the relevant facts of the cases were similar. In all cases, the discrimination occurred in consumer credit programs, such as auto lending and unsecured personal lending. The cases did not involve real estate or business loans. In all cases, the credit unions priced their consumer loans differently based on borrower credit scores. Discrimination occurred when two parties were involved in the credit transaction. Loans involving a single borrower with no cosigner were not implicated. And in all cases, the credit unions did not differentiate between transactions involving borrowers who applied jointly and transactions where cosigners were added because the credit unions determined applicants did not individually qualify for the credit requested. Different standards were applied solely based on marital status. Slide 40, please. In the example shown, which I'll read, when determining the interest rate for a loan, if two or more scores are offered, the credit union will observe the following criteria. If the loan has joint signers, the rate will be based on the higher of the two scores, unless the joint signers are not married. Then the rate will be based on the primary borrower. The credit union's sole basis for applying a different standard is marital status. The policy evaluates applicants differently based on marital status, assigning a higher loan rate to loans with unmarried joint signers when the primary borrower's credit score is lower than the secondary borrower's score and in a different risk-based pricing tier. Also, you may note in the example provided that terms to differentiate between joint applicants and applicants requiring a cosigner are commingled. This is common in the marital status discrimination cases we've observed. Violating credit unions use terms interchangeably that normally differentiate joint applicants from applicants requiring a cosigner. In these instances, upon investigation, we've determined the only difference considered is marital status. The credit union's policies and practices overtly treat applicants differently based on marital status and violate ECOA's non-discrimination requirements. That concludes the presentation from NCUA. Now I will pass it to Wes Tramiller from the FRB.
Thanks, Matt. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Wes Tramiller with the Federal Reserve. I'm a senior attorney in the Fair Lending Enforcement Section. Next slide. I'm going to be talking today about an area of fair lending risk arising from the treatment of disability, disability income, and maternity leave. Next slide. The Federal Reserve supervises over 800 state member banks, which share jurisdiction with the Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection for some banks. Next slide, please. If the board has reason to believe there is a pattern or practice of discrimination in violation of the ECOA, The board must refer the matter to the Department of Justice and has done so for a variety of violations. Next slide. Our focus today is on the risk of disability and maternity leave discrimination. With respect to disability, the ECOA prohibits discrimination because all or part of an applicant's income derives from any public assistance program, often referred to as discrimination on the basis of receipt of public assistance. This would include treating credit applicants differently because their income was from a program for individuals with a disability, such as Social Security Disability Insurance, or SSDI, and Supplemental Security Income, or SSI. At the same time, the Fair Housing Act prohibits discrimination on the basis of handicap, which is more commonly referred to as disability. Given these protections, discrimination on the basis of receipt of public assistance under the ECOA can sometimes overlap with discrimination on the basis of disability under the Fair Housing Act. Turning next to maternity leave, the ECOA and its implementing regulation, Reg B, prohibit creditors from discriminating against any applicant on the basis of sex in any aspect of a credit transaction. And with respect to the evaluation of a credit application, Reg B specifically prohibits a creditor from using assumptions relating to the likelihood that any group of persons will rear children or will, for that reason, receive diminished or interrupted income in the future. The Fair Housing Act prohibits discrimination on the basis of sex or familial status in the terms, conditions, or privileges of the provision of services in connection with the sale of a dwelling. It also prohibits discrimination on the basis of sex or familial status in making available or in the terms or conditions of a residential real estate-related transaction. For maternity leave, I'm also going to draw attention to the Family and Medical Leave Act. Although it's not a fair lending law, this law is relevant when discussing the risk of maternity leave discrimination. As you may know, the FMLA entitles an eligible employee to up to 12 weeks of unpaid leave during any 12-month period for the birth or adoption of a child and the care of such child. Next slide. Here at the board, we've seen several fact patterns that can elevate the risk of discrimination in the areas of disability and maternity leave. These fact patterns are often identified from consumer complaints. Turning first to disability, the first fact pattern is when a bank requires applicants who receive disability income to take additional steps to substantiate their disability or show that it's likely to continue for a specific period of time, often for 3 years. For example, requiring mortgage loan applicants to provide a doctor's note to show that their SSDI would continue, but not requiring borrowers with income from wages to prove that their income would continue, would constitute disparate treatment under the ECOA and the Fair Housing Act. The second fact pattern occurs when a bank lacks clear written policies regarding the treatment of disability income, or the bank may have inconsistent policies. In the absence of a clear policy, a loan applicant may face improper questions regarding the nature or severity of his or her disability. Next slide. We also see risk when a bank is not monitoring its policies to ensure that they're being implemented consistently. And I want to highlight today the risk that occurs when a bank does not make reasonable accommodations. For example, a bank may fail to make a reasonable accommodation if it doesn't allow a mortgage applicant to communicate with the bank through counsel, or when it fails to consider making other non-fundamental changes to its rules, policies, practices, or services when those changes are necessary to afford an individual an equal opportunity to apply for credit. Another example here could be not allowing an applicant additional time to submit paperwork. Next slide. The final fact patterns I'll highlight today relate to the treatment of an applicant's employment status and reasonably expected income during a legally protected unpaid maternity leave. One fact pattern occurs when a bank lacks clear written policies regarding the treatment of unpaid maternity leave taken under the FMLA. Under the FMLA, a person's job is protected while she is taking leave, and the employer must return her to her former position and salary at the end of the FMLA period. In this way, the employment is maintained throughout the leave period, and the income is resumed at the end of the leave period. If a bank does not have a written policy, it could be at risk of violating the law. For example, without clear policies and training, a bank employee may treat an applicant as unemployed, even when she's on unpaid maternity leave permitted under the FMLA. A bank's practice of not considering a woman's employment status and reasonably expected income when she is on unpaid FMLA leave for the care of her newborn child discriminates against women and discriminates against families with children. Lastly, as with the area of disability, we also see risk of fair lending violations when a bank is not monitoring its policies to ensure that they're being implemented consistently. Next slide, please. So there are several practical steps that a bank may take to reduce risk of fair lending violations in these areas. They may consider implementing clear written policies and procedures to guide loan officers and other staff regarding how to document disability income. The bank may want to have a justification for any policies and procedures it uses as well. Generally, for disability income issued by the Social Security Administration, like SSDI or SSI, a recipient's benefits award letter should be sufficient to prove the source, amount of income, and that income will continue when there's no specified expiration date on the letter. HUD, Fannie Mae, and Freddie Mac all have guidance or standards regarding disability income verification. The Bureau also has a 2014 bulletin on this issue. With respect to reasonable accommodations, banks may implement policies and procedures to address these requests. Although a bank may not be required to provide the specific reasonable accommodation requested by a person with a disability, by making an effort to provide some reasonable accommodation, a bank may reduce fair lending risk. And again, the bank may want to have a justification for any policies and procedures it uses as well. Next slide. To avoid potential maternity leave discrimination, much as with avoiding potential disability discrimination, banks may implement consistent, clear written policies and procedures to guide loan officers and other staff regarding how to verify employment status and reasonably expected income of those on FMLA-protected leave. They may also wish to consider business justifications for any policies and procedures used. And once policies and procedures regarding any of the topics that I've talked about today are implemented, compliance with those policies may be monitored and staff training may be updated accordingly. Next slide, please. For more in-depth information, included on this slide are some resources that the Fed provides for use with our bank. Other institutions can use these as a resource as well, but should, of course, consult agency-specific materials. And for additional information regarding these risks, there are also a number of recent public enforcement actions on these topics settled by DOJ, which are accessible on DOJ's website. Thank you for your attention today, and I'll now turn it over to Tim Lambert at the Bureau. Tim.
Thank you, Westra. I will talk today about some updates on the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act, or HMDA, and the slides I'll be presenting are meant to be a resource for you. I won't be talking through all the slides, but the slides that I don't talk through are there as background material for you if you want to know more. So I'm going to begin on slide 53, where you'll find a disclaimer that applies to this presentation, including both the slides and what I present. And moving to slide 54, what you'll see there is a list of the data points that are found in the 2015 HMDA final rule. These are probably well known to most institutions, and they're grouped between the existing data points, those that are identified in the Dodd-Frank Act, and finally those that were added under the Bureau's discretionary authority. Moving to slide 55. So here, what you'll see is a new development in HMDA, which was on the 24th of May of this year, the President signed into law amendments to the HMDA statute. And on slide 55, you will see there the actual language from the statute, which says, for these purposes, that the amendments provide that certain HMDA reporting requirements shall not apply with respect to closed-end mortgage loans if the insured depository institution or the insured credit union originated fewer than 500 closed-end mortgage loans in each of the two preceding years. And there's very similar language that you'll see in the amendments that relate to open-end lines of credit. There is an exception in the statute for insured depository institutions with poor CRA exam histories that still need to comply with these sections of HMDA. Moving on to slide 56. On slide 56, what you'll see is the language that existed previously in HMDA to which these amendments apply, and you'll also see that on slide 57, and also then moving to slide 58, we get into the implementation of these statutory requirements. So the Bureau's best reading of the statute is that this law was effective upon enactment. And so in order to implement it, the Bureau is doing a couple things. One is that it published an initial interpretive and procedural rule on August 31st of this year without notice and comment. And that will be followed by a legislative rulemaking that's planned for 2019 that will include notice and comment to both update Regulation C to incorporate these changes and also to address other issues that will require notice and comment rulemaking. So moving on to slide 59, I wanted to cover just a few key takeaways from these changes that were announced in the interpretive and procedural rule. So the first one I want to highlight is that optional reporting of data that's covered by these partial exemptions is permitted. So what that means is that an insured depository institution or insured credit union has the option to voluntarily report exempt data points for transactions that otherwise qualify for the partial exemption. And this is intended primarily to address concerns that institutions may have who are already collecting the 2018 data or may fall close to these thresholds and so may want to report voluntarily this information. So the next thing I'd like to highlight as far as the procedural and interpretive rule is that it includes the provision that an insured depository institution or insured credit union that opts to voluntarily report an exempt data point must report all of the data fields for that specific data point. And so, for example, if an institution decides to voluntarily report street address, then that institution must report the entire street address and can't leave off the zip code. And the data fields that are associated with each data point are outlined in the filing instruction guide for HMDA. So on slide 60, there is another key point which I want to highlight about this rule, which is that which transactions are covered under the thresholds. And in the rule, what you'll see are the definitions for closed-end mortgage loan and open-end line of credit are taken directly from the 2015 HMDA final rule. And you have the provisions on the slide there. Moving on to slide 61, this is maybe the most important slide relating to this new rule, which is the actual list of the data points that are covered by the partial exemptions. So you'll see the list there, and these are, of course, the data points and not the data fields themselves. Moving to slide 62, another key point which I want to emphasize is that in the rule for institutions that are deciding to not report the universal loan identifier because they are partially exempt, For them, a non-universal loan identifier is still required for every transaction reported. And on the slide, you'll see the requirements that are found in the rule for that identifier, that it must be comprised of up to 22 characters to identify that transaction, and those may be comprised of letters, numerals, or a combination of letters and numerals, that it must be unique within the institution, and it may not include any information that could be used to directly identify the applicant or borrower. So moving on to slide 63, this slide provides some additional information coming from the rule regarding how the negative CRA examination history will be defined. And moving to slide 64, what you'll see here is an excerpt from the HMDA filing instruction guide. And the Bureau issued on the same day as the 2018 HMDA rule changes to the filing instruction guide that accommodate and implement these changes. And so this is taking the example of property value, which is a partially exempt data field, and provides the additional instruction that for that data point, if the institution is partially exempt and not reporting the data under HMDA, then you are to enter the word exempt. You'll see also in this slide the note that for other data points, the way that the exemption is implemented is through the word exempt, the code 1111, or in certain cases, the field is left blank. So I encourage you to look at the filing instruction guide in order to find out for the particular data points you may be interested in what the proper coding would be. So moving on to slide 65, this is just a reminder that in December of 2017, the Bureau issued a compliance statement relating to HMDA data that's collected in 2018 and reported in 2019. And relevant for these purposes, this announcement included that the Bureau does not intend to require data resubmission unless data errors are material, that the Bureau does not intend to assess penalties with respect to errors in data, and that examinations will be diagnostic to help institutions identify compliance weaknesses and will credit good faith compliance efforts. And at the same time the Bureau issued this statement, all of the other HMDA regulators issued similar statements for their supervised institutions. On slide 66, you'll just see a summary of a compliance statement issued in July of 2018, which basically forecasts some of the changes that were later announced in the rule and in the FIG. And then the slides that follow simply provide some resources for you. I won't go through all of those now, but I'll just highlight a few. There are changes to the Guide to HMDA Reporting, Getting It Right for 2018 that incorporate the 2015 final rule, and then for the 2019 version of the guide, that version of the guide will also incorporate the 2018 rule. There are implementation resources on slide 67, which you may also want to consult. On slide 68, there is a resource I want to highlight, which we call the mini-FIG. If you choose not to consult with the full filing instruction guide, which is 173 pages long, you can consult this version, which is just 37 pages, and basically includes the key codes that are needed for filing HMDA, a description, a legal description of the data point, a hyperlink to the eRegs version of that provision, and then a column that shows just what the non-applicable or exempt codes would be. On slide 69, you'll see the link for the self-service knowledge portal, which is the new frequently asked questions for HMDA that the FFIEC publishes, similar to the questions that the frequently asked questions that were published by the board on the prior FFIEC website. And slide 70, you have the link to the HMDA Help portal, which has been established in addition to the HMDA Help email, similar to that provided previously by the board. And slide 71, although we won't have time to go through them today, they're just reminders about the changes to the FFIAC HMDA Examiner Transaction Testing Guidelines. These were announced last year, and they have not been changed by the 2018 interpretive rule. The slide that follows on 72 provides the key grid that gives you the thresholds for those. And then on slide 73, you have information about the key fields, which apply to the FDIC, OCC, and FRB supervised institutions. On slide 74, there is information about the policy guidance for what the HMDA data that will be released to the public. And then finally, on slide 75, my contact information. And with this, I will kick it back to Kirsten.
Thank you so much, Tim. That was a lot of information in 10 minutes. So we have some time for questions now. And our first question is actually for the Bureau. So Tim, if some of my transactions are eligible for a partial exemption under the 2018 HMDA rule, can I just leave the fields eligible for an exemption blank for those transactions?
Yes, thanks for that question. So basically, I would direct you to the filing instruction guide because there you'll see that in some cases, institution may leave the data field blank. In some cases, there's special codes report, or in some cases, the word exempt is entered. But it would depend on the data point, and the filing instruction guide would provide your guidance there.
Thank you, Tim. Our next question is for the DOJ. How did the facts of the Klein Bank case differ from past DOJ redlining cases?
So every redlining case is pretty individual in terms of the evidence. It's different in terms of geography or in terms of the protected class that's involved, or it may be different in terms of the bank's market area. But the allegations sort of in general were very similar to our past cases. We alleged that the bank had a discriminatory assessment area. We allege that the bank marketed only in white areas and that it located its branches in white areas. And in terms of the statistical evidence, we allege that in majority-minority neighborhoods, the bank drew applications and originated loans at a lower rate than comparable banks. So I would say that this is very consistent with our past cases in terms of the evidence and the legal theory, but very individual to Klein Bank and its business model.
Thank you, Lizzie. Now we have a question for the FDIC. Tara, can you please provide us with some examples of business models that have inherent fair lending risk? I want to make sure that I fully understand what constitutes inherent risk and what does not.
Sure. So inherent risk arises from the general conditions or environment in which the institution operates. So for a couple of examples would be an institution operating in a market that contains majority-minority census tract has more inherent risk for redlining as compared to an institution that operates in a more homogeneous geography. Also, another example would be an institution that allows for discretion in perhaps underwriting or pricing has more inherent risk as compared to an institution that requires loan officers to strictly adhere to rate sheets or underwriting guidelines.
Thank you, Tara. And now a question for the OCC. Catherine, if a bank uses a broker network to source loans, isn't it the broker's responsibility to ensure compliance with all applicable fair lending laws?
Thanks for that question. So I think the way to answer this is maybe go back to some basics under the laws that apply, the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, or ECOA, and the Fair Housing Act. So under ECOA and Regulation B, it is unlawful for any creditor to discriminate against any applicant regarding any aspect of a credit transaction on a prohibited basis. Reg B defines a creditor as a person who, in the ordinary course of business, regularly participates in a credit decision, including setting the terms of the credit. For purposes of ECOA's prohibition on discrimination and discouragement of applicants, the term creditor also includes a person who, in the ordinary course of business, regularly refers applicants or prospective applicants to creditors, or selects or offers to select creditors to whom requests for credit may be made. So the analysis of who is a creditor under Reg B is a fact-specific one, but in your typical brokered loan scenario can include both the broker and the party setting the terms of the loan. And then under the Fair Housing Act, the Fair Housing Act prohibits discrimination in residential real estate-related transactions extending to persons or other entities who make loans, as well as those who broker loans. Additionally, the Fair Housing Act prohibits discrimination on a prohibited basis in the terms, conditions, or privileges of sale of a dwelling. And given these broad statutory prohibitions, the risks presented by third-party originators are an important component of the OCC's risk assessment program.
Great. Thank you so much, Catherine. The next question we have is for the NCUA. Matt, does NCUA receive many complaints alleging discrimination on the basis of marital status?
No. For lending discrimination complaints, consumers most frequently allege discrimination on the basis of race or ethnicity. But for consumer complaints, there is another distinction that is probably important to consider. In almost all discrimination complaints that NCUA receives, consumers have been denied credit. They are not complaining about a difference in terms or conditions. And consumers are clearly aware of being denied credit and may associate the action taken with wrongdoing on the credit union's part. On the other hand, consumers may be entirely unaware of obtaining credit with different terms or conditions than other borrowers. In the marital status example I discussed today, credit unions apply different terms on the basis of marital status. The type of marital status discrimination I described was identified from loan policy and loan file reviews. It may not have been easily identified or identified at all by reviewing consumer complaints.
Great. Thank you, Matt. And now we have a question for the Federal Reserve. Westra, you mentioned that some of the issues you talked about today are identified through consumer complaints. Can you talk to us about the Fed's consumer complaint process and how does that process work with HUD?
Thanks. That's a great question. So the Federal Reserve's process includes investigating any complaint that we receive that involves a state member bank in an area of our authority, so that would include fair lending. Complaints that involve allegations of discrimination under the Fair Housing Act are shared with HUD, and then likewise, and I should say, clarify, complaints alleging discrimination under the Fair Housing Act against a state member bank are shared with HUD, and then HUD would in turn share the complaints that it receives against state member banks with the Federal Reserve. In the same vein, we would also refer a complaint alleging discrimination under the Fair Housing Act and the ECOA to the Bureau if, due to the bank's asset size, the Bureau had jurisdiction for the ECOA. And because of this, fair lending complaints may be investigated concurrently by both the Fed and another agency, or the Fed and other agencies. I also want to note here that as part of a consumer compliance exam, Fed examiners may consider other sources that could reflect consumer complaints. For example, examiners may review concerns raised in CRA public comment letters or by community contacts, complaints to other federal or state agencies, lawsuits by a private party or government agency, or inquiries or investigations by other federal or state agencies. Examiners may also review complaints generated through internet websites or social media and press articles raising concerns about a bank's practices. So to reduce the risk of consumer protection violations, banks can ensure that they review all of those sources, too, through the adoption of policies and procedures to monitor these complaint sources on a regular basis.
Thanks, Westra. We have another HMDA question for Tim at the Bureau. Tim, if I am eligible for a partial exemption, can I report my HMDA data for the partially exempt transactions in the 2017 format?
Yes, the answer is no. There is just one HMDA platform that's available to HMDA filers for the 2018 data that will be submitted in 2019. And basically what people will see is that in those columns that relate to the partially exempt data, that's where you're going to check for the filing instruction guide codes for exempt data fields.
Thank you, Tim. And here is a question for DOJ. What is the difference between the way DOJ defines redlining and the way the regulatory agencies define redlining?
I would say there isn't a lot of difference. We have the same definition of redlining, and we take very consistent approaches to identifying redlining. We look at the same types of information when we're evaluating a lender for redlining, and to ensure this consistent approach, the Department of Justice meets regularly with the other agencies. We have an interagency meeting, and we coordinate with the lender supervisor whenever we conduct specific investigations.
Great. Thank you, Lucy. And now back to the FDIC. How do you know if something fully mitigates a discrimination risk factor? Can you please provide more information as to what a mitigating factor is?
Sure. A mitigating factor is something that reduces or eliminates discrimination risk. And I think it's important to realize that a mitigating factor does not reduce or eliminate inherent risk, but it rather reduces or eliminates the potential impact of consumer harm due to an applicable discrimination risk factor. So a discrimination risk factor is sufficiently mitigated when examiners have determined the institution has sufficient controls to ensure that a risk factor, although present, will not likely lead to consumer harm. And throughout this process, examiners must be able to explain how a factor directly mitigates the risk being considered. So for example, discretion in setting residential real estate loan prices represents an inherent risk that may warrant further analysis. If there were substantial pricing disparities and the financial institution offers annual fair lending training to its board of directors, this factor alone would not mitigate the risk. But conversely, an institution's ongoing monitoring or audit program that conducted comparative file analysis, including appropriate corrective actions, could possibly mitigate the risk.
Thank you, Tara. Our next question that we have is for the OCC. Catherine, doesn't compliance with the Bureau's Loan Originator Compensation Rule, also known as the LOCOMP rule, eliminate the fair lending risk associated with broker compensation?
Not necessarily. For example, if the lender permits variations in compensation plans among brokers or for the same broker, this can lead to variations in pricing for similarly situated borrowers, thus increasing fair lending risk. Now, these same variations could be permissible under the LOCOMP rule. This is why it's important to consider both Regulation Z and the Fair Lending Laws in structuring compensation policies and procedures.
Thank you so much, Catherine. All right, next up is a question for the NCUA. How were the marital status discrimination cases that you discussed today in your presentation resolved?
Thank you. While I can't discuss specific cases, I can talk in general terms about how the NCUA addresses fair lending violations. We consider any consumer compliance violation that causes a consumer to suffer a negative financial impact to be a substantive violation. And generally, it is our expectation that the violating credit union will make affected consumers whole. If the violation is determined to be systemic, not isolated, we also expect the credit union to make appropriate improvements to their compliance management system to prevent or at least to allow the credit union to identify and self-correct future violations. So, for example, we might ask the credit union to revise policies, implement additional training requirements, and improve oversight. Also, if we have reason to believe a credit union engaged in a pattern or practice of illegal discrimination, ECOA directs us to refer the matter to the Department of Justice, so that could also come into play. On the other hand, violations that are characterized as technical violations, not substantive, are handled differently.
Thank you for that answer, Matt. Our next question is for the Federal Reserve. Lestra, should temporary disability income be treated differently than permanent disability income?
Thanks for the question. As I mentioned earlier, the Bureau, HUD, Fannie, and Freddie all have guidance or investor guidelines that apply to this issue and that should be consulted as appropriate. And as I talked about in my presentation, one of the common fact patterns that we see is an applicant who presents undated income, and then the bank then treats it as temporary and denies the loan application. If the disability income does not have a defined expiration date, it should be considered likely to continue into the future, even if it's not explicitly described as permanent. If the income does have a defined expiration date, which could usually be the case with short-term disability benefits or other temporary leave benefits, which could include maternity leave, the bank will need to determine the applicant's employment status, which is to say, does he or she intend to return to work, and if so, when? Banks that are considering implementing a robust underwriting policy may incorporate procedures for both temporary and long-term benefits or leave income into their policies and procedures. They also may want to do that as part of their fair lending training and reviewing policies to ensure that they're compliant with ECOA, Reg B, and the Fair Housing Act can help manage fair lending or manage the risk of fair lending violations, I should say.
Thank you, Estra. So we have another partial exemption question, so back to you, Tim. If I am eligible for partial exemptions for all of my transactions, do I still need an LEI?
Yes, so the answer is yes. And that is, first of all, to back up and say the LEI is the legal identity ID. And some people may be familiar with this as part of the universal loan identifier, which is a partially exempt data point. But in addition, the filing instruction guide asks institutions to include the LEI on their LARS as a separate data point outside of the universal loan ID. So that requires all institutions to provide an LEI.
Thank you, Tim. And another Klein Bank question. I understand that Klein Bank is being acquired by another bank. How does that affect the settlement agreement?
Most of the Department of Justice fair lending settlements include a provision that covers the situation, and that provision says that the acquiring bank, the successor bank, will fulfill the provisions of the settlement, and we have that type of provision in this settlement. So we look forward to working with the new bank on continuing the aspects of the settlement that are not yet complete.
Okay. Thank you, Lucy. Let's see. There's a question for the FDIC. Tara, after the FDIC has completed its fair lending review, does it share its risk assessment with the institution?
So the fair lending scope and conclusions memo is considered part of the examination work product, so no, it's not something that we share with the institution. However, examiners do discuss their assessment of risk at the institution, so the bank will have an understanding of the examiner's view of the risks associated with the institution after they've concluded the examination.
Thank you, Tara. And this one came in for Catherine of the OCC. You discussed loan origination compensation as being a potential source of fair lending risk. Can other fees give rise to potential fair lending risk?
Yes, they can. So origination fees, of course, are usually a pretty important component of mortgage loan pricing, but any component can potentially give rise to fair lending risk. For example, if a bank charges higher fees to unmarried joint borrowers for the same loan-related service that is provided to married joint borrowers, it risks violating ECOA. And this is because, as Matt covered earlier, ECOA prohibits discrimination on the basis of marital status in any aspect of a credit transaction.
Thank you, Catherine. And here's one for the NCUA. Matt, what are NCUA's 2019 Fair Lending focal points?
While we may select focal points in advance of a fair lending examination, we generally do it at the individual credit union level based on risk factors, not globally for all fair lending examinations. So I guess the short answer is there aren't any designated focal points, but I will say in 2018, our safety and soundness examiners began performing limited scope HMDA reviews to evaluate credit unions' good faith efforts to comply with new HMDA reporting requirements. Those reviews are completed separately from our fair lending examinations, but it probably is worthwhile to mention them here. The limited scope HMDA reviews will likely continue in 2019 and will only be performed in credit unions required to collect and report new HMDA data fields.
Thank you, Matt. So it looks like we have time for one more question, and I will turn the last question to Tim. Tim, when can we expect the Reg B proposal to implement small business data collection?
Bureau has included in its fall 2018 regulatory agenda some information about those 1071 provisions. And what you'll see on the agenda is the Bureau noting that in light of the need to focus additional resources on various HMDA initiatives that are now on the Bureau's agenda as well, that the Bureau has adjusted the timeline for implementing the 1071 statutory directives, which basically amend the Equal Credit Opportunity Act to require financial institutions to collect, report, and make certain information concerning credit applications made by women-owned, minority-owned, and small businesses. So the Bureau has now reclassified the 1071 project from pre-rule status to longer-term action status.
Thank you so much, Tim. So it looks like we're coming to the end of our time. So I'm going, before I turn it over to Jean to conclude the session, I want to thank all of our presenters who joined us today, all of you in the audience for tuning in, and very importantly, I want to thank Katrina Blodgett, Jason Liu, and Jean Ward for making this webinar possible. With that, I'll turn it back to you, Jean, to conclude our session.
All right, thanks so much, Bertha. We will be sending an email to our participants with a link to the survey. Please do take a moment to fill that out. We read every response and strive to make our sessions better based upon your feedback. So please take a couple of minutes to do that. And I'd like to echo Bertha and thanking our presenters and the whole Outlook Live team for their time. And as a quick reminder, remember to check our website, www.consumercomplianceoutlook.org, for the archive of this call and for information on upcoming sessions. Thanks again for joining us. This concludes today's Outlook Live webinar. Enjoy the rest of your day.